There's no way he committed suicide. Never in a million years will you convince me of that. There is no way. I remember that ninth round just sitting there covering my face, looking through my fingers, going, oh my God.
Hello and welcome back to Boxing's Life Stories. I'm your host, Tris Dixon. Many thanks, first of all, to Adam Booth for being my guinea pig last week and to those of you who took the time out to both listen and comment to the podcast. Wherever you listen to this, if you can review it too, that would be great. We're on Podomatic and iTunes. If you like it, that's great. If you don't, let's just keep it between us, I guess. My guest this week is a really solid guy. I've actually known him longer than I've known Adam Booth. I reckon about 17 or 18 years, and I really can't say enough good things about him. He has always been extraordinarily helpful to me. He's a genuine guy, a great interview. We did dinner in New Jersey at some mobster hangout about a decade ago, but he's a good family guy. And you know what I mean in boxing when I say he's one of the good guys. We as a sport, entrusted him with a boxing treasure. We knew he would do right by him. This sporting treasure would become a world champion at two weights, yes, but he came into our hearts as the most beloved fighter of a generation. Yes, that fighter made millions, and yes, he made it into the International Boxing Hall of Fame. But his legacy was far removed from money. His legacy was heart, courage, and guts. And my guest was with him every step of the way. They had ups and downs, and they were on what has to be one of boxing's most wild roller coasters ever. And they were together for for nearly 20 years. The boxing treasure I'm talking about is, of course, Arturo Thunder Gatti, and the man who was in his corner from the very start until the sad, controversial, and heartbreaking end was Pat Lynch. We'll get straight down to it. It's now 2018. We are 30 years removed from when you started managing fighters. That's right, isn't it?
Yes, that's correct.
And who were the first guys that you had, and why did you get involved with them? Because you don't go to school, you don't go to college saying, I'm going to be a fight manager, right?
No, that's for sure. You learn on a job, too. I have a ticket brokerage firm in New Jersey, and one of my clients was involved in boxing and was very close with Bob Arum. So when the 1988 Olympic team came out and the alternates, Bob decided he was going to split the team and put half the fighters to New Jersey to turn pro and half in Vegas. He formed a small group there of investors to get involved with the Vegas people, and my client here put together a few guys to do the New Jersey group. So he had asked me if I'd like to get involved as an investor, and I did. And so that was my first introduction. And that was, we called them the Triple Threat, which was Ray Mercer, Al Cole, and Charles Murray. So that was my first step into boxing.
Wow, okay, so some quality operators in there. And when did Joe Gatti come in? Joe Gatti wasn't too far behind then, was he?
No, it was in 1990. What had happened was the investors in the group, the Triple Threat, we had purchased a boxing gym in Newark, New Jersey. And Matthew Hilton was fighting Doug DeWitt. I believe it was for the WBO middleweight title. And Mr. Hilton, Matthew's dad, was looking for a good gym to train out of. So I had suggested, you know, I'm more than happy to open a gym and let them use our gym. And that's what had happened. They had all come down there into Newark, and Joe Gatti happened to be the sparring partner of Matthew Hilton. So I would go down every day, open a gym, watch the workouts, and Joe had said to me at the time that, you know, he wasn't getting busy. He was a young fighter. He was only a four-round fighter, and that the only time he really fought is when one of the Hilton brothers would fight. So he said he would, you know, love to come down, stay in New Jersey, and get his boxing career going here. So I had spoken to Mr. Hilton, who was managing Joe at the time, asked him, you know, would he be okay with that? And he said, fine. And that was my introduction to Joe. And then we moved Joe down into Jersey City and started managing him.
Okay. And then where did Arturo fit into that?
So then Joe had said, you know, I have my younger brother, Arturo. He's not going to do the Olympic trials this year. He'd rather just turn pro. So I want to bring him down here. So I said, all right, bring him down and, you know, we'll work with him too. And that's when I had first met Arturo.
Who was the better of the brothers? You know, who was the best pro prospect out of the two?
Well, I mean, both were very, very good punches. Believe it or not, Joe was probably more skillful at that stage. But Arturo just had this incredible ability to just, you know, a pit bull type ability. Just never quit, never die, just, you know, the pedal to the metal all the way. You had to hold him back sometimes in sparring.
So there were signs very early on that he would provide some real excitement in a pro career.
Absolutely. I mean, it started right off really with his second and third pro fight. His first pro fight was at the Meadowlands Convention Center.
That's it. Jose Gonzalez, yep.
Yep, that was June 10th of 1991, and it was actually a walkout bout. He fought after the main event. We didn't want him to fight earlier because Joe was the main event on that show.
He really put on a clinic. He showed his boxing skills. He fought smart. And I remember him telling me how nervous he was before the fight because the guy had old tattoos on. He looked like he just got out of prison. Arturo has this little baby face, you know. He was only 19 years old. But it was a great win for him. And he looked terrific doing it. It was a shame that it was a walkout bout, though.
Okay. So there were signs he was going to provide excitement. Were there also signs that Arturo was a wild child?
Not yet. That was too early. He was still... you know what? Maybe I shouldn't say that. He still... Yeah, he liked to go out and still have a good time, but he was a little more focused as he was getting his career off the ground.
Okay, so he was quite a hungry, ambitious kid.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the second pro fight, we went down to the Blue Horizon, and I believe it was Luis Melendez.
That's right, yeah.
Who he fought. He wound up knocking out Melendez in 19 seconds, and at that time broke the Pennsylvania state record for the quickest knockout, which I believe was held by Marvis Frazier at the time.
Oh, okay.
So with that, we wound up getting on in America here on Eyewitness News that night. We got the sports clip. So It was pretty cool that right away he got a little bit of fame there, you know. And fighting in the Blue Horizon, if you've ever been there before, it's a pretty tough venue to fight in because the balcony is basically overhanging the ring where you could almost touch the first row of the balcony. It's a very, very tough place to fight for fighters. And if you can fight there, you can fight anywhere.
And in fact, that was where Arturo first fell over, wasn't it? Well, not fell over, but he came unstuck against King Solomon.
That is correct. That was his first loss, was in that ring.
And,
absolutely.
And that was a split decision. What do you remember about that? It was his seventh fight, like you said, in the Blue Horizon.
Yes. I remember not being crazy about fighting that fight. We were doing a show up in Great Gorge that Joe was fighting on, and I wanted him to actually fight on that show. But make a long story short, Russell Peltz had convinced someone who I was working with at the time to put him on his show at the Blue Horizon and to fight, which was not smart at all, to fight a Philadelphia fighter, a slick boxer in his backyard on his home turf, just at the time didn't make much sense. Anyway, it kind of worked out better because we cleaned house a little bit after that fight, and then really it was me steering the ship the rest of the way for the rest of his career after that.
Okay, so and then obviously you were like you said you cleared the decks out of the ring and Arturo cleared the decks in the ring, and that sort of led you to Tracy Patterson for the world title.
Yes, but before we get to back up one, his third pro fight was a very interesting fight. It was a kid named Richard DeJesus.
I was going to ask you about that because I believe that was the main events connection, and he was the underdog for that.
All happened. That's when we signed with Main Events. What had happened was we had opponent after opponent fall out, and we wound up taking Richard DeJesus on short notice. And Russell Peltz had been the promoter of the fight. It was in Newark, New Jersey. He came up to me the night before the fight, and he said, you know, word around ringside through the reporters is that the little Gotti's probably going to lose tomorrow night. I just want to give you a heads up. So, of course, me, a young manager, all panicked. I went up to the hotel room, and I started to explain to Arturo that we had opponents fall out. And he stops me mid-sentence. He goes, listen, Pat, if I can't beat a kid named Richard DeJesus, he said, I'll never be a world champ. Don't even worry about it. And I believe he knocked him out in like 92 seconds or something and pretty much ruined the kid's career. He shattered his nose. It was just an amazing knockout. After the fight, the dressing rooms were actually up a flight of stairs. And I remember walking back to the dressing room, and I see two people come flying by me, and it's Lou Duver and Dino Duver jumping two stairs at a time to get to our dressing room.
And Lou Duver didn't jump two stairs for anybody.
No, exactly. Well, that's what I was laughing about. Like, oh, my God, I never seen Lou move like this. And then we had a talk in the dressing room. He asked me to come up to the office that, you know, they would love to sign Arturo. Went up there the next week and signed with Main Events and stayed with them for the rest of his career.
Did you have...
They gave him a Jeep Renegade as a signing bonus, and that was, he loved that truck. That was his pride and joy.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, it was great.
So over the course of... Because obviously it was unusual in the sense that you, Arturo, Main Events, I mean, there was a little bit of shuffling in the corner in terms of the trainer throughout his career, but yes. nothing major. It's unusual for you guys to go, or people in boxing, to all stick together through the whole journey. Did you either come close to splitting up with Arturo at any point, and were there any overtures from King and Aram?
There was no problem with Arturo and I. We were solid all the way through. We did get calls when his first contract was running out with Main Events. It's a very interesting story. His brother Joe was fighting Terry Norris at the time back in San Antonio. And before the fight, Joe had asked for a $30,000 advance on his purse. So Don King had given it to him. It's the only dealing we've ever done with Don King. After the fight, Don said, I'm not going to take the $30,000 back. You know, we'll work it out at another time. Make a long story short, Don didn't get a chance to take the money back. I'm sitting in my home on a Sunday afternoon, Tristan, phone rings. And this is when Arturo's contract was up with Main Events. We're obviously in negotiations to re-sign. And the phone rings and he says, Pat? I said, yeah. He goes, Don King. Now, how he had my home phone number or anything, I don't know. I understand the young Agati boy is going to be a free agent. I said, yeah, that's correct, Don. You know, there is a matter of that $30,000 we never squared up. That was with the other brother. It has nothing to do with Arturo. But I found that pretty comical.
Yeah, definitely.
Make a long story short, obviously, you know, Arturo and I were very loyal. I mean, if you were good to us, and, you know, we weren't going to, you know, jump ship or anything like that. There was no reason to leave Main Events at all.
Yeah. So when, by
they treated us great.
By the time Patterson came around, did you think it was the right time? Did you think it was maybe a little early? Because Patterson had been around the block and he was quite a seasoned operator by comparison.
Well, what had happened was we were Eddie Hobson had the title, and Arturo had sparred with Eddie a bunch of times. They were both under the Main Events banner. In fact, one of the first training camps in Arizona, I remember Arturo didn't have a fight, but Lou said, have him come out, it'll be a good experience. And he sparred with Eddie, and I remember calling him one night, and I said, what's going on? He goes, all the sparring partners are going out tonight. You know, I'm just going to stay home. I said, you're not going to go out with everybody? He goes, listen, this kid, Eddie Hobson, has whooped my ass 3 days in a row. He said, I got to figure this out. I ain't going out till I get back. Get him back. And within a week later, he was holding his own and giving it back to Eddie, which was great. That's the type guy he was, you know. He was incredible when it came to that. And anyway, back to that story. I didn't mean to...
No, that's great.
But, Eddie Hobson had the title, and he was fighting Tracy Patterson. I think it was on a Saturday afternoon. It might have been CBS Sports or one of them. And Patterson knocks him out. We were number one, in a number one position there. So the minute that Hobson got knocked out, I swear it was a matter of 30 minutes. Dino Duver called me. He said, listen, I want to start negotiating this Tracy Patterson fight right now. He said, you know, what do you think? I said, listen, it's our dream to fight for a world title. Let's do it. And that's how that came about.
I mean, Patterson had about 60-odd fights at the time.
Yes.
And
yes.
But you felt Arturo, did you think he maybe had, just the timing was right. Was it about timing?
Yes. Yeah, I think the timing was right. He was ready for it. And you know, he was so excited to fight for his first world title. That, Tris, I honestly think that he might have been overtrained for that fight. You know, we did a 12-week camp down in Virginia Beach, and when you see the fight, you could almost see a little bit of fatigue setting in near the end there, and we almost lost it near the end because he started to get fatigued, and I know it wasn't due to lack of conditioning. I think it was over conditioning.
When he won that world title, was that when he came off the rails a little bit and started to enjoy the good life too much?
It started not right after that. I would say probably after Wilson Rodriguez going into Gabriel Ellis, you know, right around that time is when he started to be a boxer and a rock star both at the same time.
So Rodriguez is interesting, isn't he? Because obviously that was really, although he had the title by then, that was the first proper roller coaster fight, wasn't it?
Oh, man, that was. And I remember HBO wanted us to fight somebody else, and I was insisting on Rodriguez. I thought that would be the better fight for us. And oh my God, that fight was just Boxing After Dark. I think the fight on Boxing After Dark before that was Junior Jones and what was it, Barrera? Anyway, make a long story short. And then when Gotti Rodriguez happened, that actually put HBO's Boxing After Dark on the map big time. But that was a great fight.
Because Rodriguez was winning, wasn't he? But Arturo was getting all busted up,
yes.
What became a familiar story. And then he pulled that left hook finish out of nowhere.
Yes, and that was the first time he was ever knocked down in his career at any point. And it's so funny they asked him afterwards. He had been bugging me. He wanted to buy a BMW sports car before the fight. And I kept saying, Arturo, let's just wait till after the fight. There's no reason. Let's wait. We don't have to do this now. No. So we went, we got the car. So they asked him after the fight, what went through your mind when you went down? He said, two things. One, there goes my BMW car. Two, Pat Lynch just had a heart attack.
Did he have the Jeep Renegade still then? Was he growing a collection of cars?
Actually, I think he did. I think he got rid of the Jeep after that.
Okay. And so with regards to Rodriguez, I mean, what was you were obviously the manager. You had to deal with the fallout and the hype that then came with it. But boxing was buzzing after that fight. Fight of the year contender. Yes.
Well, the thing, the knock really, I think, that came to me was that I put him in too quick. After coming off of the Patterson fight, which was such a tough fight, where he was swollen so bad, for us to come back and fight 3 months later in March was a little bit too quick is what, you know, I was hearing from the commentators.
Yeah.
But it really all worked out because that fight was just, I remember someone telling me that the New England Patriots, one of the coaches went into the training room of the Patriots. I knew a player on a team, and that's all he was talking about. Did you guys see that fight last night? And that really, you know, put Arturo on a map, or made him a somewhat household name, you might say.
Okay. Then there was a run of fights. You fought Patterson again. You fought Calvin Grove, who was a veteran of the game. And then came Gabriel Ellis in another fight of the year contender. I mean, was there a point through these fights, the hard fights, and when you saw that Arturo was vulnerable and in hard fights, was there a time where you were thinking, just this isn't going to be a very long ride?
Well, everybody felt that the way he was fighting, it was going to, you know, it would be a short career because who's going to continue to take that kind of punishment? And the, you know, the crazy thing is he could really box. I mean, he proved it time and time again. He proved it in the second Patterson fight. He boxed beautiful. And just, you know, I think he played to the crowd a lot. He loved that, you know, the crowd roaring. He loved to brawl. And sometimes he wouldn't keep it under control. He would just go for it. But there definitely was a concern.
And with Ruelas, I mean, talk me through what it was like to be in the corner around that. Because obviously it was a fifth round win, so he made relatively short work of it for Arturo. But it was another thriller, though, wasn't it?
Oh my God, yeah. I mean, that actually stole the show because the main event was Lennox Lewis and Galata, and we know what happened there. I remember. Right after he knocked Ruelas out, Lou DiBella, who was with HBO at the time, jumped out of his seat and said, "This kid is the greatest TV fighter ever."
Wow, okay.
With Arturo.
And you guys weren't even half done by that stage.
It's nuts. It really is. I mean, when, you know, obviously when jumping ahead a little with De La Hoya, you know, HBO really thought that was our going away present. You know, they're going to give him a nice payday, thanks for the memories. And he wound up having a second career after that.
Yeah, of course. I mean, there were then a run of three fights and three losses with Manfredi and two against Ivan Robinson. Did everything nearly end then after the second Robinson fight?
and after three back-to-back losses? Because in this day and age, you know, there's a lot to be said for an undefeated record. It's not something I'm particularly keen on, but people like a padded record. And with Artura now, the losses are mounting up by comparison to a hot young prospect or a champion.
Yes, but, you know, the amazing thing is HBO still wanted him back. I mean, win or lose, because of the way he fought, they wanted him back. And I think after that, the three losses is when, you know, we sat down and we had a talk and said, listen, you know, either, you know, retire and be a rock star or be a fighter. You can't continue doing both. It's just impossible. And I think it was after De La Hoya when he found Buddy McGirt. He went down to Florida and he really did some soul searching. That he changed his whole training regimen. I mean, you know, the training camps before that, they were good. They weren't great. You know, He'd have a slip up here and there in between, in training camp. But after that, everything was great.
You say about him being a rock star. What do rock stars do?
Oh man, party hardy. Go out, the nightclubs, the girls, you know, the rock star lifestyle, you'd say, you know.
And he, you know, what would he do? Would you always be in touch with him? Would he go off the radar for a couple of weeks or what?
It would never really be a couple of weeks. You know, there'd be days I wouldn't hear from him. But he'd pretty much check in. And obviously, if there was ever a problem, the phone would be ringing at 3:30 in the morning and, you know, things like that. So it was definitely like having a fourth child.
We talk about those three losses, and by now, not only were the losses mounting up, but the hard fights were and the mileage. Did you get criticised for being a brave manager? I don't mean, obviously, for that Patterson fight or the Rodriguez one where they say that maybe you took it too quick, but were you in the firing line at all for saying, look, come on, give this kid a break?
Not really. I think it was pretty good. I got questioned a couple of times as like, you know, when do you think enough is enough and things like that, you know. But, you know, I had deep conversations with Arturo, and I believed in him. I believed that he would walk away when he felt he had nothing left to give. And I know that's tough to say, but I believed him. I really did. After De La Hoya, he said, you know, everybody's telling me I'm done, Pat. You know, what do you think? I said, well, you know yourself better than anybody. I said, you know, take your time and see if you still want to do this. He goes, I definitely still want to fight, but, you know, they're telling me, am I done? I said, listen, you know, go down, relax. He said, well, number one, I want to do is I want a new trainer. I just need a change from Hector. You know, Hector was great. He was a great trainer for him. It all worked out, but I think it had run its course, and he was done. Yeah. And wound up going down to Florida. Told me he's going to take about 3 weeks, 2 weeks, a month, whatever it is, to find a trainer. He's going to work with a few people and see how he feels. He was down in Vero Beach for 2 days, and he called me up, and he said, I want to hire Buddy McGirt as my trainer. Okay. I said, Arturo, it's two days. I thought we were going to take our time here. He goes, you don't understand. This is the guy.
Okay. Just rewind a bit, because we kind of jumped over a couple of fights. There was obviously Ray Munoz, there was Gamache, there was Eric Jakubowski, and then Joe Hutchison. And I wanted to just ask you in particular about the Joey Gamache fight, which over the course of time has become extremely controversial, hasn't it? Which where Arturo put on a load of weight after the weigh-in, and then he just destroyed Gamache, who never fought again.
Right. Well, first of all, before that fight with Reyes Munoz, he put on about 19 pounds after the weigh-in, which people couldn't comprehend at the time. But I saw it. He did it. What had happened with the Gamache fight, number one, I told him, when HBO comes in here and asks you to get on that rinky-dink scale that they throw on the floor and ask you to stand on there so they can put on TV how much weight you gain, do not do it. I said, Reyes Munoz wound up going to the hospital. You went to visit him afterwards. We do not get on that scale. It does us no justice. We do not need it. Make a long story short, I leave the dressing room to go out somewhere, come back. The girl from HBO had convinced him to get on the scale. Okay. So I believe he gained 18 or 19 pounds from that fight. Where the controversy comes in is when he got on the scale, Trish, he put his hands up in the air. And Marty Rosengarten, who was a photographer, who still has the pictures, when Arturo put his hands up in the air, the needle leveled out. So the commissioner said he made weight. Johnny Boz from Joey's side started screaming, he didn't make weight, he didn't make weight. Arturo stepped off the scale and drank a drink right away. So at that point, he wasn't getting back on the scale. If he was over, if he took a healthy piss or he took his underwear off, he would have made the weight. It would have been a fraction off. So what had happened was, after he put on all of that weight, the vicious knockout that took place, you know, that's where the controversy came in. That's where we got sued for $30 million. And the state of New York got sued. The commission got sued. Everybody got sued after that. It was eventually thrown out. You know, my suit was out. Arturo's suit was out. I'm not sure what the state wound up doing with Joey. But I can tell you wholeheartedly that there was nothing done in that fight underhandedly or anything when it came to the weight.
Did Arturo feel bad with what happened with Joey?
Well, yes, he did. You know, he was a little mad at Joey going into the fight because Joey was bringing up the fact that he lives a cleaner life than Arturo. Arturo's a party animal. And Arturo was hearing this, and he was really ticked off going into that fight. He really was.
Okay.
And I could give you a great story in the dressing room. HBO says it's 5 minutes to go. So he says, heck the mouthpiece. No mouthpiece. Heck the left in Gleason's gym. So now everybody's scrambling. We have no mouthpiece. So we get, ask anybody. Nobody has. We have a $2 football mouthpiece that you put in the hot water. He tells his younger brother, go run and get a pot of hot water. Gets the hot water. HBO goes 2 minutes to the walk. He's sticking this mouthpiece in there. Chews a bunch of gum, sticks it in the bottom of the mouthpiece, puts it in his mouth, shoves it in, bangs his two gloves together and says, I'm ready, let's go. And that's how he fought that fight with that $2 mouthpiece.
Gee.
Everybody in that dressing room panicked but him.
Yeah, wow. Wow, that's incredible. You know,
just to say, yeah. I felt terrible what happened to Joey. I mean, Arturo looked so much bigger than him when, you know, by the time fight time came, as you saw, he put on so much weight, and it really was a vicious knockout.
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, so obviously that was in New York, and some of these comeback fights were in New York, and then he boxed Hutchison up in Quebec. But yeah. Obviously Arturo was known and became synonymous with Atlantic City. So we all know why he became an attraction, because he was an action hero. But why Atlantic City? Why? Because everyone else goes to Vegas or New York.
Well, you know what it was? New Jersey took to Arturo. You know, he was built, even though he was from Montreal, he was built out of Jersey City, New Jersey. And it just started to build, you know, the exciting fighter that he was. And it just, more and more fans just started coming on. And I think the first time we went to Bally's, Ken Condon was he's such a gentleman, a great guy to deal with. It was easy. That became home. And we were selling the arena route. There was really no reason to go anywhere else. In fact, the dressing room now, I mean, if Springsteen plays there, they play in the Arturo Gatti dressing room. That's where they get ready. They named the dressing room after him.
So Bob Arum and Kathy Durai both gave you a lot of credit in an interview I read recently for being able to sell tickets. Was that you? Were you going around selling tickets, or was that Arturo? Like, how did that work?
I had my ticket agency, which I've had for years and years before the boxing business. So, you know, every time I spoke to a client or anybody, I would always push Arturo's name early on. So it just kept building and building from there. So having my, having the ticket agency really helped also.
Okay. I'm with you. And then just, you've obviously mentioned Oscar De La Hoya a couple of times. That fight, for many, it was a pension fight for Arturo. Were you in agreement with that at the time? Or did you actually think, you know, Arturo could produce something incredible and do something? You know, where was your heart of hearts?
I will, people are going to say I'm crazy, but, you know, we had talks. I really thought that he was going to give him a good fight. I really did. I mean, we had a tremendous training camp. I mean, I think Teddy Atlas even mentioned it on ESPN the following week that, you know, when he had spoken to me that, you know, Gotti didn't just come for the payday. They really, really believed that they could give him a good fight. And we did. We brought in the best sparring. Cesar Bazan was fabulous for us in sparring. And we had a great, great training camp. And Oscar was just too big and fast, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, when you were watching it, did you regret doing it? Or did the money just, you know, make too much sense?
I, I'll tell you what I remember running to the corner, and Bob Canobio of Fight Facts, of CompuBox, I apologize, grabbed me afterwards and said, "You told Hector that it forgot Harry to stop." But I said, "Yeah." I went into the corner. I said, "Hector, I'm not going to watch him take any more punishment. I mean, if this thing starts to get a little out of hand right now in this round, stop the fight." And that's what he did. If you remember, Hector Roca threw the towel, and Arturo was so mad at that. And I told him, I said, "Arturo, I was the one that did it. I did it. Don't blame Hector. I told him to stop the fight."
Was that the highest paid fight of Arturo's career, the De La Hoya fight?
No. That wasn't actually. There was a few others that were more. Mayweather, of course. I believe he even made more money for the Leija fight, believe it or not.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Once we, after the Ward trilogy and stuff, he started to get paid very well by HBO.
Okay. So he came back after the De La Hoya fight, and he looked quite slick against Terrell Miller, didn't he?
Yeah, what had happened was we spoke with HBO and said, and they obviously said, "Are you guys crazy? You really think he has something left?" And I said, "Yeah, I do." They said, "Okay." They didn't even give us a choice of opponents. They said, "Okay, you have to fight Terron Millet." So I went to Buddy and I said, "Yeah, that's perfect, no problem." And then after what he did to Terron Millet, I remember Kerry Davis of HBO coming up to Buddy McGirt and saying, "What are you, a magician? What did you do? This kid looked phenomenal." He said, "You know what I did? I just reminded him what he forgot, and that's the box, and be smart. That's all I did. I didn't teach him anything," which is a credit to Buddy, you know?
What if Arturo had boxed his entire career and hadn't done what he became so famous for? What would he have achieved as much, if not his legendary status?
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know if he would have been the Arturo Thundergatti as we know today. I mean, because he's known for those incredible fights. I mean, fight of the year 3 or 4 times. I mean, just rounds of the year. It's just, I don't know if he strictly stuck to boxing, if he would have been as big as he was. He would have won titles and stuff like that.
You think on skills, on skills alone, he would have won world championships?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So after Terrell Miller, came 3 fights that just small club shows. we had the trilogy, obviously, with Mickey Ward. I was fortunate enough to be at 2 out of 3 of them, the first and the second. And the first one was just insane. I mean, we'll just say, like, they said stars make fights, and that's why I went there thinking it was going to be explosive. But did you think we would get what we got in fight one, which some people do say is the best fight of all time?
Yeah, I didn't. It was crazy. I was so confident in Arturo. I said, "He's looking so great." I remember getting the tape of Mickey and Shay Neary, and I showed it to Arturo. And he never really watched tape a little bit. He says, "Pat, honestly, I'll fight them both in the same night." I said, "Okay." After the fight, Tris, we're in a dressing room, and it's just him and I now in the back lot. And he said, "Do you remember me years ago telling you the toughest fight of my life is going to be when I fight somebody just like me?" I said, "Yep." He said, "I just fought somebody just like me." Could not believe it.
Do you know what I thought you were going to say there, Pat? I thought you were going to say, when you said, when you're out the back with Arturo after that first fight with Mickey, I thought you were about to say, "Are you ready for Shay Neary now?" You said you'd have 2 in the same night.
Oh, my God. And then I remember the fight's over. I'm walking back to my hotel room with my wife, and I ran into Bob Canobio again of CompuBox, and he has this blank look on his face, and he says, "I got one word: brutality." And he kept walking. People were amazed. They really were amazed. I remember that 9th round, just sitting there covering my face, looking through my fingers, going, "Oh my God." And then Buddy McGirt came down the stairs after the 9th round, and he said to me, "Pat, I don't like what I see. His lower lip is shivering. I don't like this." Buddy was in slight panic mode there. And I said, "Buddy, you can stop it at any time you want, anytime you feel in this 10th round." Arturo goes out and wins the 10th round.
Would you, during that 9th round, did you want it stopped? Were you thinking this is just a bit too much, or did you think this is Arturo, this is what he does?
That one there, I would not have faulted Frank Cappuccino to stop it. I'm really surprised that it kept going. But and then the thing is, Mickey's people thought that the fight was stopped because Buddy was really going to stop it right after the ninth. And the other corner man, our good friend Mikey Red, grabbed Buddy by the shirt and said, ho, don't stop this thing yet. And tried to pull him back down because Dickie Eckman put his hands up in the air that the fight was over. And Cappuccino goes, fight ain't over. We got another round. It's like, oh, my God.
Was that Arturo's most action-packed fight? Was that the one really, even though in defeat?
I'll tell you, there were a bunch, but I would say, yeah, that probably was out of all of them. I mean, I can go back to way back now to Leon Bostic. That might have been his first 8-round fight up in the Friartuck. Oh, my God, what a fight that was. So he's been in some, but that first Ward fight was, that was brutal. And it was funny, speaking to both guys after the trilogy's over and we're hanging out, Arturo's attitude was, if I come in better shape, I box him, I can win this fight. Mickey's attitude was, I get in a little bit better shape, I can stop him this time. So that second fight, I really didn't even want to see it. The one was enough for me,
Yeah, but that second fight was brutal, but brutal particularly for Mickey, wasn't it? Because Arturo boxed that second time, and he outboxed him, and he hurt him early, popped his eardrum, and Mickey really struggled in that second fight.
And I'll tell you, Mickey will tell you, it's so funny. If you watch the tape, I forget what round it was. Mickey said, I was against the ropes, I was out of it. He hit me so hard with a left hook, he woke me up. And I was back in the fight.
Yeah, Mickey said something similar to me. So throughout that second fight, which was back in Atlantic City, you were calmer in the corner for that because it wasn't as back and forth. Were you always quite – once Arturo had a foothold, did you think that was it?
Yeah. Yeah, I know. But you know what? When he hurt Mickey, when he popped his eardrum and Mickey fell face first into the turnbuckle, when he come back, he went after Mickey, but he said he was smart enough. He was, putting an arm a little bit, but he had to lay off. He said, because if I don't get him out of here, I know he's coming back the last minute or the last 30 seconds. So Arturo was smart enough to lay off a little bit because he knew he wasn't going to get him out of there in that round. And a credit to Mickey. He fought, equilibrium off with a broken eardrum the rest of the way. Just amazing.
Were you worried after that first fight? I remember I went over to Mickey's house in Lowell, actually, and Mickey had some offers, didn't he? Because he won. So his stock was higher, and he could have fought Kostyuzu, I think, at the time, and there were some other decent offers out there for him. Did you, or were you or Arturo ever concerned that he might go in another direction and not give you guys a rematch?
Yeah, we knew he had to win. We were just what we were banking on is how bad HBO wanted the rematch. So we knew that they would pay. So we knew that there wasn't enough, there wouldn't be more money in any other fight but the rematch. They wouldn't pay for more money for the Zoo fight. The most money they would pay would to see number two with Gotti Ward. And that's what happened.
Did you think, obviously Mickey's a fighting man, did you think he'd jump back to it as well?
Yeah, I knew he'd take it. He was going to get his first $1 million payday. And like I said, he felt he was going to stop Arturo in the second fight.
Yeah. And the third fight, there was high drama again. So it looked like Arturo was going to outbox him again and have things his own way. And then Arturo broke his hand on Mickey's hip. And then Mickey knocked him down. And then there were different things that might swing the fight one way or another. But he managed to keep his nose in front, didn't he? But there was were there times in that where you thought, oh, my God, it could go anywhere?
Oh, man. Well, when he broke his hand, he whispered in Buddy's ear, my hand is broken. So Buddy said, what do you want to do? He says, no, we keep going. And
you can see that on the tape, can't you? You can see that on the tape. Yep.
Yep, absolutely. And, you just think about it. You got a broken hand, you have to throw it. And you could see he was, working, and he just had to throw it every now and then. The pain that must have been is unbelievable.
And then Mickey did chop him down with a big right hand as well, didn't he?
Yes, yep. And I'll never forget, that was right by our corner where we were sitting. I was like, oh, my God, no, don't tell me this. Just great. And a funny story, both guys, as you know, went to the hospital.
I was just going to ask you that, yeah.
And I get to the hospital, and Sal Lanano, who was Mickey's manager, standing there outside of Mickey's room. I said, how's he doing? He goes, no, he's doing okay. He goes, can you believe this kid? He goes, I get into the ambulance. I go to give him the oxygen mask. He slaps it out of my hand. He said, Sal, I need it in the third round. I don't need it now.
And then it was amazing. Obviously, their rivalry, it can almost bring a tear to a fight fan's eyes. It was everything good about boxing. But they were next to each other in the hospital, weren't they? Just talking smack and having a laugh and everything.
fought, and Arturo says, "How you feeling?" He says, "How you feel?" It's just amazing. And then Arturo said after that, Mickey had announced he was retiring, and it was done. And he said, "How cool would it be if Mickey would walk me in the ring?" And I said, "You know what? You should call him up, man. That would be great." And then, of course, Mickey became part of the entourage. It was great. It's a great story.
What did you think coming out of that? And we talked about already the career of hard fights. What was left for Arturo coming out of that Mickey War trilogy? Or what was left of him? What was left of him?
Oh yeah, jeez. Obviously he felt beat up after the fight, took a rest, and then he felt okay. His dream was to get another world title. He had the one from Tracy, and he wanted to win one more world title.
And with the momentum from the two wins over Mickey Ward, and obviously everything that they meant commercially, and how high his stock was, that got you the title shot straight away.
Yeah, that was Gianluca Branco, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Tough kid.
Did you fancy the Branco fight? Was that one that you thought, well, if he's going to beat anyone, Branco's as good as anybody?
Yeah, I thought it was a really good fight, and I knew we had a very good chance of winning the WBC title, which is something he always wanted. HBO really wanted us to fight someone else. They weren't crazy about the Branco fight, but we said we want a world title, and that's the fight we really want. So they gave in to us, and we fought it, and he wound up getting his green belt. It was great.
Which is incredible, wasn't it? Because so many people were saying Arturo had been done several years before, and now here he was, 2004, and on top of the world.
Yeah, unbelievable. World champion again at 140.
And not only that, but then he was, I'm going to call you a brave manager. Maybe that's not doing you credit, because that's an insult in our industry. but you then compared him with Leonard Durin, and that match was made commercially because Durin was an exciting fighter, and they wanted another Mickey Ward type fight. But Arturo absolutely annihilated him, didn't he?
It was great. The body shot. Well, the funny thing is, as Durin was out of Montreal, Canada at the time, by way of Romania. And Arturo said he trained so hard for that fight. He goes, "Listen, I can't go visit my mom if I lose for this guy. He's in Montreal. There's no way." And I was so happy. Everybody else was disappointed. They wanted to see a war. And I think Teddy Atlas actually had Durin winning the fight before the fight, saying, "I think Durin wins." And just when he landed that body shot and he went down, I just said, "Please don't get up. Please." And he didn't get up. I was so happy. I don't know if you see it. You see Arturo just come running and jump into my arms right after that fight. It was great.
Because that has to be, on paper, arguably his best performance, or his best win. Do you know what I mean? Not one of his greatest wins, but in terms of what was expected to happen and what actually happened.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you come out of a fight against Leonard Durin not getting hit, and you get a stoppage. God, and then I think, Durin never fought again after that. That was his last fight.
Yeah, that's incredible. And then came Jesse James Leija.
Yes. And the reason we got the Leija fight was because he had beaten Francisco Bajardo on HBO. So that made him a viable opponent for us.
Because Bajardo was one of the young guns, wasn't he? He was being built as a young prospect.
Yes, he was, man. He was a hot prospect when he first came out. And I thought that was a can't-miss kid. It just goes to show you in boxing, Trish, it's crazy.
Well, we talked earlier about timing, and the timing was right. It was obviously Jesse James wasn't as far gone as they thought he was.
Right, exactly. Yeah, no, that was a good fight for Jesse. And then, when we got that offer, they sparred years and years ago in San Antonio, Arturo and him, so they were kind of friendly. And Joe Souza, who was our cut man, obviously, he sat down, he said to Arturo, "Listen, Canuck, I hope you understand." He goes, "James was my boy." He goes, "Joe, I totally understand. We have to use a different cut man in that fight." Because
Joe
had to work Jesse's corner.
Okay. And then, obviously, we're going to go into the Mayweather fight. There was, you talk about levels. We talked about Oscar and we talked about Arturo. There was a lot of people who predicted what happened was going to happen, in the sense that Mayweather was going to be too sharp and it was going to be punishing.
Yeah.
And it was exactly that, wasn't it? It was a mismatch on the night.
Yes. Yes, it was. It was a horrible performance. It was. I shouldn't say a horrible performance. It was just the money he wanted. He wanted to fight. You know, Mayweather was talking. He always wanted Arturo. Arturo wanted that mega payday that he was getting for that fight. So you know, you look at it that way. He got what he wanted there, but he was totally outgunned and outclassed.
Was that the hardest fight you had to watch?
Yeah, I didn't. I just it was rough. And even when he told Buddy, "No, give me one more round," I wish they didn't even do that the next round. You know, I wish it would have stopped.
Yeah. And then, but he and Floyd hated one another at the time, didn't they? I remember when I spoke to you for the Mayweather book that I did. You were saying, you know, they had to have separate press conferences and everything.
Yes, yeah, they did separate press, and then Floyd actually crashed Arturo's press conference near the end, and it was the first time they faced each other. Really, Floyd crashed it. We left. I think was really at the weigh-in. That was the first time they faced each other. He didn't like him. He didn't like his father. His father, had a lot to say when we were fighting Oscar. He said that Gotti's just a punching bag, a swivel on his head. Just really derogatory comments that were uncalled for.
Yeah, I remember that, and I remember and he was saying that Arturo's face was starting to tell the tale of a hard career and that kind of stuff, wasn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, yes. I remember that. Around about that, well, did you as a manager, did you get criticism for the Mayweather fight, or do people see the business side and think, well, it's his biggest payday? You know, you've got to get the money, you need to take those kind of fights.
Yeah, I really didn't get criticized for it at all. You know, I think people understood that it was, you know, a mega payday for him, and that was the reason for taking the fight.
Yeah, there was then the last victory came against Thomas Damgaard, who I remember from. Being out in Atlantic City before, because he did some training out there. I think when Brian Nielsen was getting ready to fight Ray Mercer, and Damgaard had been in town then. And then obviously Arturo beat him, but then there were the losses as he wound down against Baldomir and Alfonso Gomez. Yes. Do you regret that he took those fights?
Well, I think that after he beat Damgaard, crazy, we had a shot at another world title against I just went blank on it. You just said his name.
Baldomir.
Right? Baldomir. I apologize.
Yeah.
That was for another world title. So.
Yeah.
And then after Baldomir, I said, that's enough. No more. We can't do it. We had one fight left on our HBO deal. Arturo begged and pleaded. Kathy Duva didn't want it. Buddy walked away. I didn't want it. And he begged and said, listen, even if I win and don't look good, I promise you that's my last fight. I will not fight no more. And no discredit to Alfonso Gomez, but 3 years, 4 years before that, he doesn't stand with Arturo Gatti in the ring. He doesn't stay with him, you know. And to see that was just terrible, horrible.
I mean, there's a tragic picture, isn't there, with Arturo on his haunches in the ring with his lips split and stuff. Like, that's a like, when you look at that image now, what do you think, you know, We should have stood firm and not let him do it.
We should have stood firm and just insisted that he didn't fight. And just, you know what? The other thing, Tris, though, he would have probably felt it wasn't finished. He probably would have felt that, you know, I still had one more. Might have did something that he regretted, you know. Take a fight maybe 2 years later than that, I don't know. But that was it. It was over. There was rumors he was going to fight again. But that, I would have stopped that any way I could have. Anyway, I was not going to let fight anywhere.
You know, Arturo obviously lost a few, but what did Dana say to you, Dana White once say to you about Gatti in the UFC?
It was great. I went to an LA Clipper playoff game with my son in LA, and we were walking, and my son Kyle said, Dad, there's Dana White. And he's walking with some security. So I walked over and said, Dana, Pat Lynch. So he stopped. So we started talking. He goes, let me tell you something. We modeled pretty much the UFC after Arturo Gatti, because he proved you got to just fight your heart out, put on a show, win or lose, you know, we're going to bring you back, and that's how we feel. And I thought that was one of the greatest compliments I ever heard.
Really? And then you and Arturo, like I said, you guys stayed close, and you got him out of scrapes, and, you know, you fought by his side, and you did all the business deals with him. Why were you and he so close? What did he give you, and what did you give him?
I think when when Arturo came down from Canada, his dad had passed away maybe 3 years before that or so. And I think I became like a father figure, a big brother to him. And we just grew so close. I mean, he was an usher in my wedding. He's the godfather of my youngest daughter. All our holidays we spent together. If I was down here, even in Florida, visiting my in-laws, he would fly down and have Easter with us or Christmas, whatever the holiday would be. And we just became very close.
What were the best times for you and Arturo? You know, was there a vacation you took or Christmas or you know, was it, what were the best times?
Probably a bunch of the vacations we went on, you know, down in the Bahamas, at the Atlantis we were, or spending time in Florida, or just the times that really stick out in my mind were probably the Sunday afternoons when my wife would cook a big Italian meal after his fight, and on our way home from Atlantic City, he'd come to the house, we'd replay the fight from the night before, and just eat a big Italian meal and talk about the fight, and then he'd crash out on the couch and leave the next day. Those were great times. Great, great times.
Was Arturo a good kid, or was he a troublemaker?
Great kid. Great kid. Listen, he fought hard, he played hard, but he wasn't a troublemaker. He didn't look for it. He had a heart of gold. I mean, I say this all the time. If I needed a babysitter on a Saturday night, I could call him up and he would come over and babysit my kids. He was just and do everything for anybody. You know what I mean?
After Gomez, did he stay on the rails in retirement?
He did a radio interview up in Canada. Saying something about fighting again, and I immediately got a call from someone.
Oh, I remember this. Yeah, we spoke at that time. Yeah.
Yeah, and about 20 minutes later, he called me. He said, hey, listen, you're probably going to get a phone call, but, you know, they took it the wrong way. What I said is I would only fight again as if you were in my corner. And that's what I had said. I think I told you. I said, listen, you want to get back in the ring? You want to train a fighter? You want to manage a fighter? You want to promote a show? I'm all with you, but you're not putting the gloves on again. It's over. And so, no, I know that. I don't know if I was being tested there or not. But
so all that time in retirement after Gomez, you guys were still tight, weren't you? You spend a lot of time together, even in retirement, and spoke to each other all the time.
Yes. And then he wound up moving back up into Montreal. And then I would see him just when he would come down. He'd always come by the office and stuff like that. That was probably the last year of his life.
Yeah. And then July 11th, 2009, a date that's probably indelibly etched on your mind now, the news came at 37 that he died. I mean, where were you when you heard? How did you find out?
I was in Italy on vacation in Positano, and we went out to dinner. And I came back, and I was in a room with my wife, and my daughter came in from the room next door, and she said, Dad, call Uncle John right away. It's an emergency. So I didn't know what it was. And then my brother relayed the news to me, and I just fell back. I remember I was standing up. I just fell back on a bed, and I couldn't believe it. I was just, like, shocked, you know.
How much longer were you in Italy before you could fly back?
I probably had about 2 or 3 more days there, which was brutal. I wasn't sure if I should go from Italy right to Brazil. There was a million things going through my head at the time. And then I had spoken to his younger brother, and he said he's got his plane ticket. He's leaving now as soon as that happened. So he had gone over.
So it was on the news, everything, wasn't it? Did you see it on the news in Italy where you were?
I don't remember that, Trish, to be honest with you. You know, my phone was just going, ringing off the hook. And I remember seeing a friend, believe it or not, at breakfast at the hotel the next day, and he had a blank stare on his face. So word traveled immediately. Everybody knew, you know.
Yeah. What were your initial thoughts? I mean, obviously it came out. It was also suspicious, and we'll touch on some of the finer details in a sec, although without dwelling upon it. What were your initial thoughts? Because people were saying suicide.
There's no way he committed suicide. Never in a million years will you convince me of that. There is no way. And the way they say he did it, it's impossible. But, you know, my first thoughts were, you know, he got murdered there. She was arrested for the murder originally and then released, I think it was 18 or 23 days later, and they changed their ruling and called it a suicide.
Sure. You hired... a super high price investigative team, including it was Paul Cialino, wasn't it? From you know, to get to the bottom of everything, he produced this huge dossier. And what did you want from that? Did you either want justice, or was that how you coped, or was that your or was that your way of holding on to try and?
Here's what I wanted. I didn't want his children growing up thinking he quit on them, because he would never do that in a million years. I just wanted the truth to come out of what really happened that night, and we still don't know. You know, for his kids to go through life thinking their dad killed himself, it's a horrible, horrible thing. And I just wanted to do whatever I could to get that cleared up. And unfortunately, you know, it happened in a foreign country, which, you know, we have no control over. I took it as far as I think I possibly could. And I think unless, you know, someone comes to God and finds Jesus or whatever and wants to come out and give us the truth on what actually happened that night, we're never going to know.
We're nearly a decade removed. Are you at peace with what's happened, just given that the time's come and gone and that you're helpless to do anything about it?
No. It's still a very big open wound for me.
What do you live with? Hate, animosity, sadness, all of it?
I wouldn't use the word hate. Sadness, yes. You know, I pray that, you know, the truth would come out someday. I don't know if it will. It would be wonderful if it did, but it's hard. It's really hard. You know, it's not a day that goes by that I don't think about him.
Is that said literally every day you think about him?
Yes, always. He's always on my mind. Always. You know, I still have, you know, obviously all of the memorabilia that we have and all the posters from his fights hanging in my office at home, my office where I am. And I just, you know, I look at it every day.
Yeah. And what do you think when you look at that memorabilia and when you look at the ride, you know, do you smile?
I was just going to tell you, it brings a big smile to my face.
Yeah,
it really does, because who would have thought that, you know, this 19-year-old kid would come meet me and we would have this tremendous ride and become so close, and just you know, he made boxing history going down as one of the greats.
Are there still people that you sometimes spend the odd bit of time with that bring you closer to Arturo, like someone like a Lou DiBella or a Mickey Ward, people that you might bump into in boxing where you can share some stories? Does that make you feel a bit closer to him?
Yeah, it does. It's always good to talk about, or if someone will bring up a story, or I'll bring up a story. It's great. It brings a smile to my face every time we talk about it.
You've had other fighters subsequently, including another TV fighter who was Glenn Tapia, who had some exciting fights on the TV. But we look at Arturo and we call him, you know, the boxing roller coaster and, you know, the human highlight reel. But you were actually driving the blooming roller coaster. I mean, what was that like? What was that like?
God. Oh, my God. That was a roller coaster. In and out of the ring. I was on two roller coasters.
with Arturo, everything that you invested in him, and I don't mean financially, I mean the time and the love and the effort, and over the spell of nearly 20 years, you were so emotionally invested. Could you honestly take a kid and do that again? Do you have that within you?
I don't. I think at this point in my life, you know, I'm very happy. My children are grown now, 25, 24. My daughter's 19. She plays lacrosse in college. I get such a thrill out of going to all of the games. I don't think that I would be doing a fighter justice if I signed on right now and tried to bring him from a four-round fighter and do it all over again.
Yeah, okay. Pat, is there anything else you'd like to add?
I think that's it, Tris. Always great talking to you, man. Always.
Yeah, likewise. It's nice to see you. Thank you very much for persevering with my technical glitches earlier. Hey, look, I know it's hard for you to talk about this stuff. I can see, you know, because we're FaceTiming, I can see in your eyes that you're kind of like a fighter, really, that, you know, you've probably got the only amount, certain amount of time that you can spend talking about the stuff before the damage or before the wounds start to open again. I did have, in fact, one last question actually before I let you go.
Yeah.
we've talked in the past about Arturo and how he sort of died before he could really get the fruits of his labor, in the sense that he deserved a long and happy retirement. Did you actually think that Arturo might be compromised in terms of having a brain injury or CTE down the line? Was that something that you dreaded or thought could happen?
Well, seeing it now more and more with football players and whatnot, it definitely, I didn't think about it at the time because everything seemed to be fine, but you know, there probably or could have been damage down the road. I don't know. I really didn't dwell on it at all. He always seemed okay to me. I didn't see slurred speech. So it wasn't really there. And Dr. Bodden, who did the, I hired him to do the second autopsy, had said to me that he said for a fighter who's been in everything he had been in, he couldn't believe in what great condition his brain was in.
Okay.
After he did the autopsy. So that kind of made me feel a little better.
Yeah, sure, sure. Okay. Well, Pat, that seems like a real glum note to end on after all that. But I do, like I said, I do appreciate your time. I do appreciate you being at the end of the phone, as always. And I remember I was probably one of those, well, I know I was one of those guys phoning you in Italy for comment at the time when you were out there. And I know, obviously, the time that we spent subsequently talking about Arturo and all the times you set me up with Arturo for interviews, I'm always grateful. And it was great. Even though I only came on the ride from about 2000 onwards, I was really appreciative for being on that tail end of your ride with Arturo.
Oh, please, it's our pleasure. You're a great guy. Always did the right thing.
Thanks, Pat. We'll keep in touch and really appreciate it.
For sure, Trish. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.